Welcome to the Angus Table, the podcast from Angus Australia. I'm Scott Wright, the CEO at Angus Australia. Each episode will bring conversations with breeders, industry leaders, innovators, insights, stories and ideas that matter and hopefully add value to your Angus operation. Whether it's genetics, markets, pasture management, marketing experts or people shaping the breed, this is where the Angus community pulls up a chair at the Angus Table. Thanks for joining us. Good morning and welcome to the Angus Table. Today we've got a very special guest and a friend of Angus Australia, Mark McCulley, the CEO of the American Angus Association. I've been privileged to, I would say, become a friend, Mark. We've got very, very similar roles and welcome to the podcast this morning.
Oh gosh, it's a pleasure. It's great to see you, even though we're just here on Zoom, but a privilege to be on your podcast.
No, thanks, Mark, for joining, and listeners will be interested to know, and many of them, many of you will have had the chance to meet Mark. Mark came to Australia for the World Angus Forum last year and attended quite a number of the events and the pre-tour and the expo, the forum in Brisbane. So we're delighted to have you along the journey, Mark, and finishing with the gala and dinner in Brisbane. And I've had the opportunity to visit your convention a couple of times, and I know that you've met many of our members over the years in different roles, and you've hosted a number of people from Australia to the office there. And so lovely to have you on the deck.
Well, it was a fantastic trip back in May. Boy, I just can't congratulate you guys enough, and such incredible hospitality. It was a great event. Definitely a highlight of the year for sure, and just got to meet some great people, got to see some great Angus cattle, just a fantastic event. And now, Scott, as we're trying to plan and put plans in place to host the 2029 World Angus Forum here in the United States, we just keep pointing back to how great of a job you guys did and trying to match that bar that you set for the World Angus Forum. So the standard is high, but it was a fantastic event. And again, congratulations.
No, thank you, Mark. Thanks for your comments. And we look forward to being in the US for the World Angus Forum in 29. Mark, just to dig into your organization, do you want to give us an overview of the American Angus Association? In some ways, it's like the big brother for Angus Australia. Can you give us a bit of an idea of the scale, the different programs you run, and what's your field of operation there, Mark?
Sure. So the association here in the U.S. has been around for some time. Started back here, and we had the first Angus cattle coming over to the States in 1873, and the association started with the herd registry in 1883, so about 10 years after that. Fast forward to where we are today, we're comprised of about 22,000 members. About 4,500 of those are junior members. We count those in our youth members. We count those in our total count. So, of course, about over 17,000 adult members. We'll register a little over 300,000 animals into the herd book every year in our registrations. And over time, the association has grown in ways of, the distinct divergence from the traditional breed association happened back in the 1970s when we started a branded beef program as certified Angus beef. And that was started in 1978. So today, we actually operate with the American Angus Association as the parent company, if you will, the umbrella. And then we have four wholly owned subsidiaries within the American Angus Association. So, of course, the association does the traditional type of work. We do the registrations and the transfers and the keeping of the herd book, of course, and all our member services and our youth events and activities and shows and so on and so forth. And then we have certified Angus beef, which is our branded beef marketing arm. To give you some idea, we have about 300 staff in the combined organization, and a little over half of them work on certified Angus beef. So that has been very much a growth vehicle for the breed here in the United States, and that we're able to take commissions paid on the use of that trademark by our packers and reinvest that into marketing efforts each and every year. And so that program has continued to grow and really drives value for our Angus cattle here in the States and I hope around the world as well. So that's a subsidiary company. We have Angus Media, which is a subsidiary company, wholly owned. All these are wholly owned by the parent company. And that produces our Angus Journal, our Angus Beef Bulletin, so a couple of our traditional print publications. We also are like everyone, have ventured into a lot more digital marketing and digital media services for our breeders. We have a sailbook business that we do. We do website designs. We have Angus Genetics Incorporated, which is another subsidiary that we work obviously very close with Angus Australia and the World Angus Evaluation. That's our that is our genetics business, if you will. That is our interface with all our genomics, all the genomic business that goes out to our genomic testing laboratories. All that runs through Angus Genetics Incorporated, or AGI. And then we have a foundation. That's our fourth subsidiary. We're so blessed by having so many generous donors over the years that have built that foundation up to where now we are able to provide about over $800,000 a year back out in scholarships and youth programs and things for our young next generation of Angus breeders coming up. So that was maybe more than what you were looking for, Scott, but that's kind of the organization, a little bit of a nutshell, kind of five different companies all within one of the parent company of American Angus Association.
Well, that's a great overview, Mark. From a governance point of view, you've got also a board of directors. And how are they appointed or elected, Mark?
Right. So we always say we're very much a member-driven and member-centric organization, like you are. We have a delegate process. So each state is, or district, but largely you can think of them as states here, that have a number of delegates that they can send to the annual meeting to elect the board of directors and do any of the other business of the association, such as changing of the bylaws and things that are reserved for our delegates. That delegate number is determined by the number of registrations and the number of members in a state. So Montana has more delegates than Massachusetts has here, but those delegates all come together once a year and they elect a board of directors. We have five directors that are elected each year for a 3-year term. They can serve up to two consecutive 3-year terms. They can also potentially stay on through the officers, treasurer, vice chair, and then chairman of the board. So in essence, someone could be on for 9 total years on the board. But those members that are elected to be directors, they're Angus producers, right? And they come to our board meetings. We just completed a series of board meetings last week, thinking about their operation, but they're really there to represent our membership. We have a very diverse set of members that have been elected to the board. Some run, you know, fairly large operations, smaller on size, some are multi-generational, some are first generational. Nice diversity of geography in terms of the types of operations and the environments that they operate in. And so we're very blessed to have a very diverse and very engaged board of directors. And then they sit on the parent company board, the association board, but then we have 9 member boards that guide each of the entities. And I always think of them as a bit of a subset of the bigger board. We do have an industry representative that can sit into those entity board governance from time to time. But it's again, it goes back to it's very much a member-driven, member-centric governance structure.
And Mark, on one of my trips to the convention there, you kindly invited me along to the commencement of your board of directors meeting there, and I've had the privilege of getting to know a few of your directors, and they're very passionate, like ours are, about the breed. And it was quite a privilege to meet them, speak with them, and see how it kicks off. I think a little bit larger board than we have, so you must have good organizational abilities there, Mark.
We try, but no, we're very, again, very fortunate to have a very diverse group. And I think the thing that always impressed me, they leave their hat at the door when they come in. They really come and serve and make decisions for the greater good and for the bigger organization, the direction of the breed and the member, that diverse membership that we represent. So we're very fortunate to have a great board.
No, that's great, Mark. Now, Mark, you've been the CEO a little while of the American Angus Association, but previous to that, you were heavily involved with CAB. And I thought we might just dig into CAB a little bit. It's obviously been the flagship program, which has really developed the market for Angus beef, but not just on American shores, more widely around the world. So you want to tell us a little bit about your background and your involvement with CAB?
Sure. Well, so I grew up, I have to admit, I grew up with Hereford cattle. I did not grow up an Angus kid, but I grew up coming up through the shows, and here in the States, our livestock judging programs are very prominent, and went through college on livestock judging, got to be a coach of a livestock judging team when I was in graduate school at Michigan State University. And through that, I actually left. I was on a faculty position at Michigan State for a while and left there to go work for a cooperative that was really working at, I was managing a beef improvement program that was really focused on helping producers improve their genetics and then helping them market their feeder cattle at the end. In that process, I stopped by Worcester, Ohio, where the Certified Angus Beef office was at. I had a couple friends that were working there, and that visit turned into a job interview, and I stayed, as I always said. I got to do several different roles there at Certified Angus Beef. Initially started as the director of packing, so working with all our licensed packing companies, and I got to run the sales side of things for a little bit in business development, and ultimately was over production and supply chain initiatives of what was going on with Certified Angus Beef. Got there, I was there for 19 years, so really got to see a lot of growth. Got to see honestly a change. When I always say, when I was first there working with a producer group, the question we got all the time was, "Where's my premium? Where's my premium?" You know, and we were constantly trying to answer that question of, "Hey, we're creating value. The consumer wants this product. We're selling more, but our segmented supply chain, we weren't quite getting those premium signals all the way back." Well, probably the thing that maybe changed most in my time there was the evolution of value-based marketing systems in the States, that grids, as we would call them, to where fed cattle, once they hit a Certified Angus Beef target or a prime, the dollars were flowing back, and the feeders were now looking for those feeder cattle that could do that on a consistent basis. And that question of where's my premium definitely started to become less and less of a frequent question. And so got some incredible, you know, my background was animal science, some meat science, but I truly didn't. I always said I kind of understood how cattle got into the packing plants or the abattoirs, and I understood that a good steak came out to me at the restaurant, but I didn't understand the whole supply chain and all the distribution and the purveyors and all of what goes on and how important those group of businesses and people are to delivering that great beef eating experience to the consumer. And at Certified Angus Beef, I got to see that firsthand because the brand gets to engage largely where we put most of our resources, retail, food service, restaurateurs, that sort of thing. And so fantastic experience. I got to learn and probably see the industry maybe a little bit differently because of two decades of literally every day kind of getting to see that entire supply chain from genetics to a high-end chef. Yeah.
That's interesting. Mark, over that period of time, have you done some quantifiable work on what that premium is for Angus producers in the US that are selling the feeder steers? Is there some way? We did some work here over the last 8 years, and we think it's about 15% over crossbreds and what we call flatback cattle. But what sort of premiums over the longer term have you been able to achieve in the US?
Yeah, and we've tried to get at some of that, Scott. We've even gone so far as to try to quantify the value of the growing Certified Angus Beef demand and what that's translated into on the price of registered Angus bulls. But as we all know, there's so many factors that drive that. And so maybe not as sophisticated of our models. I think the thing we know today, on average, a Certified Angus Beef carcass, an animal that qualifies for Certified Angus Beef, is worth at the packing plant $50 more than its even an Angus counterpart that doesn't meet the specifications. And And that's on top of the choice select spread. When it gets up into prime, you know, now we start to see premiums up around $200. And so that's on a per animal basis. And it's now today, we probably have 80% of our fed cattle are sold on some sort of a formula or grid-based system. So it's it becomes a pretty significant amount of dollars, value-based marketing dollars that are getting passed along. But probably not the sophisticated analysis that we need to try to do to really tease that out a little bit more.
Okay, no, but it seems to be very successful, Mark. Some of our listeners today, they might not understand the difference with CAB and some of our Angus programs in Australia. What are the broad specifications for an animal to go into that program, Mark?
Right. So I always kind of consider it a bit of a two-step process. I mean, first, the cattle have to be Angus influenced and Angus type, as we define it here in the States through working with USDA. And we also have plants in Canada, and we work with the Canadian Beef Grading Agency. And so the same specifications would apply in both places. So those cattle, that's a live animal specification that they have to be predominantly solid black, no white behind the shoulders or above the flank. And today, 72% of all fed cattle coming into the packing plants in the States meet that specification. It's not a terribly hard specification to meet. Where the difference really materializes is in our carcass specifications. The primary, the number one and the most difficult specification to meet is our marbling specification of modest zero or higher. So that's in our system, that's average choice. You know, so today we're bumping up around 40% of Angus influenced cattle. So those black hided cattle will meet all of our carcass specifications. And the number one factor that cattle miss on is marbling. And so that is one of 10 specifications. We also have a fine texture marbling specification. It eliminates what we would call coarse marbling texture. We also have a specification for a ribeye size, no longer than 17 square inch or bigger than 17 square inches. We have a carcass weight specification, a back fat specification, a muscle thickness specification to eliminate the dairy influence. Then we also have some things on appearance, no dark cutters or no capillary ruptures. We call them blood splash or blood spots that you might see. And then no hump height to eliminate the Boss Indicus cattle, no hump height over 2 inches on the neck. So I kind of bounced around there, but I think I caught all 10. But the specification there that is the most difficult to hit. And I would say the one that's most important to the consumer eating satisfaction is marbling. And that is the modest zero or higher.
Well, that's an excellent overview, Mark. That's fantastic. How important has the CAB brand been to the growth of Angus in the US? That's a big question, but it really has driven that growth. What have you observed?
Yeah, I mean, it truly, you know, and again, I'm trying to say this in a way that doesn't sound like that certified Angus beef alone has driven the beef industry here in the States or driven all the success of the Angus breed. That's not the case. But I will say, you know, it wasn't about, you know, 20, 30 years ago, beef demand was eroding each and every year. We were sharing statistics that 1 in 4 of steaks was unacceptable in terms of tenderness and eating quality. And today, with a focus on improving quality grade, and specifically, I would say what certified Angus beef has done for an industry is given producers a target. I think in many ways, we as cattle producers tend to be cattle producers. We tend to not think of ourselves as necessarily even beef producers. We tend to think of beef as a bit of a commodity. And for years and years, we got paid that way. We all got paid the same price, whether if your product was better than mine, we got the same price. So there was no incentive. What I believe certified Angus beef has largely done is it's given producers a target to shoot for that's aligned with how consumers assign value to our product. Not how we as cattle producers assign value, but truly what the consumer thinks. And what we have found year after year is as we grow sales, We put more product out in the market. We get more cattle to hit our specifications. We grow demand. And as we grow supply, the spread gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And that probably is a little counterintuitive. We tend to think of it as at some point, you know, the more supply you should put out, that premium should get narrower. And then in fact, it's gone the other way. What we believe is going on is more consumers are being able to access the product. More grocery stores and food service companies and restaurants are able to build their business on a consistent, high-quality product. And if they have that access to that product, they can build a plan to grow and expose more consumers. And so it's just kind of been this big snowball that continues to roll and get bigger and bigger. And then with that, Angus cattle have truly been, you know, the genetics that have been able, Angus breeders here in the States have put more selection pressure on marbling than other breeds. And so that gap between Black Angus cattle and the other breeds in terms of marbling genetic merit just continues to get bigger and bigger. And alongside that, Angus cattle are easy calving and they're great mothers. And we've been able to select for fast growing, efficient cattle. And so all of not having to sacrifice those obviously important and critical production traits to improve the eating satisfaction of our product. And because the breed's been able to do that, we've had breeders that have been able to use the tools to, you know, maybe fight those antagonisms or correlated traits from time to time. I think that's resulted in really the growth that we have today. But, you know, today, I think the figure we saw and calculated last week, 27% of U.S. fed cattle now qualify for certified Angus beef. We're producing more prime today. We have a higher percentage of cattle grading prime than we have grading USDA select. When I entered into this business, roughly 45, close to 50% of the fed cattle in the States were grading select. Today, we produce more prime than we produce select. It's almost become a thing of the past. And that focus on quality is why we've got all-time record beef demand here in the States, I truly believe.
That's fantastic, Mark. That's a great overview. Mark, you've looked at our industry. You've looked at very deeply, you know, your Angus industry. What, just to flick back slightly, what do you see as some of the similarities and differences between the two industries, the two countries, Mark?
Well, by no means am I any sort of an expert on your industry. Of what I got to see and what I've witnessed, and you know, I think, you know, keeping a focus on the fundamentals is vital, and probably some of the challenges we have in our States today. One of the downsides of value-based marketing is it sent a very, very distinct signal for pounds and quality. And at times, if we're not careful, we can maybe even forget about some of those other really important functional traits. And I think we've, you know, from time to time, you know, we've gone down this single trait selection path. And I see my exposure to many of your breeders probably watching some of the mistakes we've made. I got a sense your breeders are very, very aware and very focused on you know, foot quality and structure and functionality and fertility. And not to say our breeders are not. I'd say we've probably put more focus on foot quality and longevity here in the last, you know, three to five years. It tends to be kind of the one of the first discussions I get into at breeders. But that is most certainly a commonality across. And I'd say, you know, what I witnessed, you know, your breeders are most certainly, you know, keeping those most important functional traits at the forefront. I'm starting to, and I guess got the exposure of the import. Obviously, I know the importance of exports and some of your, whether it's Pacific Rim and some of your other super high quality focused markets. So got to see a feedlot there at my time, and you know some subtle differences of how the feedlot was set up, but very, very similar to, you know, how we run feedlots here in the States and the importance of days on feed. You guys kind of manage that a little differently in terms of days on feed, but, you know, some very, very similarities around, you know, targeted genetics and feeding those cattle out to hit those high quality markets. But, you know, at the end, I think, you know, we're all rally and we get around this Angus breed of cattle. The other very obvious similarity is we're still in the people business. No matter how much more technology we introduce to what we do, we're still in the people business, whether that's in Australia or Alabama, that doesn't change.
That's exactly right, Mark. You and I probably know both firsthand that we're in a very strong people business. I think your industry would be very similar to ours, and we did some genetic trend work for the World Angus Forum, and it's a credit to the breed and breeders in both countries that there's been just as much progress on the maternal and functional traits as there has been on the production traits. I think so. I think really puts Angus in a great place to be that balanced breed that manages to at least hold some traits but make improvement, as you say, with structure. And there's a definite trend towards people being very aware of that as they breed cattle in Australia. But I'd say in both countries that it's been a strength of the breed going forward. Mark, I guess looking at the product, do you get a sense of the Angus product that comes from Australia into the US? Is that do you see brands in the marketplace? You're probably not as quite as involved now that with the association more than CAB, but yeah, do you see any penetrance of Australian brands over there?
I do from time to time. You're right. I'm not quite as when we travel. I still try to get into grocery stores and go walk the meat case as much as I can. But I don't tend to probably be as up to speed on that as I used to be. But I do from time to time. Definitely see some products coming in. Sometimes it maybe tends to be maybe, you know, some of the grass finish product and some of those niche markets that here in the States, we don't tend to do a very good job of going after some of those markets. I know that was some of the early product that you guys capitalized on.
All right. Excellent, Mark. From your previous comment there, you mentioned longevity in cattle. You did a lot of work on functional longevity as a breeding value. Have you had much uptake with your breeders in regards to using that, Mark?
It has been, I think, very well received. I think it was one of those traits that, call it stayability, call it functional, we call it functional longevity. I would say it was a trait that we had heard from breeders for some time that we needed to quantify. It was just a matter of making sure we had enough data and good enough data that we felt confident in putting that out. And so, you know, we rolled that out here last year, in a research EPD kind of be going on about a year and a half ago. And then teat and udder, so two udder EPDs that udder suspension and teat size that we rolled out kind of similar, and then put all of those, incorporated those into our dollar maternal wean calf value index. And I think that was a very welcomed move by our breeders to give credit to those obviously very important traits. You know, we continue to put a lot of emphasis on, you know, genomics are incredible, and we need genomics, and they can do some pretty incredible things in our evaluation, but they're only as good as that phenotypic data that our breeders turn in, right? And so we continue to really stress that. We put more emphasis on some of our maternal plus and our inventory reporting programs, really getting at those cow traits. You know, one of the things for us, Scott, here is that we tend to see breeders that are turning generation intervals a little bit faster, maybe than what they've been in the past, and so some of those 4 and 5 year old cows are maybe even being sold out of the registered herds into commercial herds, and we tend to maybe kind of lose some of that longevity data, and so we're probably putting a little more emphasis on working with some commercial operators, some non registered breeders, some commercial operators, trying to collect more of that cow data in those commercial settings where we can probably get more repeated measures over time and finding those. We know in a commercial outfit, you know, those cows that stay around a long time and get bred on time and bring in a heavy calf, those are the ones that make money. And trying to make sure we got enough of that data flowing into our database to fine tune that genetic evaluation as best we can. But in general, I think, you know, like every new EPD that comes out, there's, you know, they tend to do a pretty good job, you know, finding the ends. Sometimes in the middle of that bell-shaped curve, you'll find you know, over time that tends to sort out a little bit better. And I'd say that's probably the case. That's probably how breeders are interpreting our functional longevity and teat and udder even today.
Okay. That's great, Mark. Mark, you're the CEO, so you're front and center of where the association and the breed needs to go in the US. What things are you considering at an association level strategically, and what are some of the big items you're thinking about and the board might be strategizing about going forward? What do you see from your chair?
Sure. You know, I think, Scott, one of the biggest things we've probably spent time thinking about and trying to anticipate where the industry is going is around what the future of genetic evaluation and specifically new traits of development. I mean, I think we'll always have some really robust evaluations with calving ease and weaning weights and even carcass traits, because those are traits that typically our breeders are able to go measure those phenotypes and collect that data and get it submitted to us. I think the next generation, when we're starting to get into things like health traits, you know, bovine respiratory disease, when we start, you know, here in the States where we raise, you know, cattle and at higher elevations, you know, things around congestive heart failure and some of these other traits where we kind of label it non-traditional data, meaning it's not data our breeders have the ability to measure. It's going to take more collaboration downstream. Maybe even it's some things around healthfulness of beef and fatty acid profiles. I'm not sure where all of these maybe new traits, things that are measurable and heritable that we might be able over time to incorporate into, you know, helping select cattle that excel in those particular areas. How do we do that as a breed association? It's probably going to take more partnerships. It's going to take more collaboration. I go back to it's because our breeders are not going to have that phenotypic data to be able to turn into the breed association. And so we see it a little bit already today. We see private companies that are out able to measure some of those traits and do some genetic evaluation that are offering, you know, some traits and some tools outside of the breed associations, right? And so just figuring out, again, how do we best maybe collaborate on some of that R&D? How do we incorporate that and making sure that, you know, we as an association, as a breed registry, there's still an awful lot of value in the pedigrees and in simply our ability to deliver these tools out to an industry in a third party incredible way. So we're spending a lot of time thinking about that. I think that's a pretty fundamental shift to the business, at least, you know, here in the States. And I would suspect very, very similar there. You know, that's probably the big one. I mean, we spend a lot of time talking about just an evolving member and what does a member today expect out of an association? And, you know, there was a day where, you know, we had one or two ways to communicate with our members. Today we have about 500, I think, different ways and 500 preferred ways by members, right? And so as an association, I think that's one of the things we're also spending some time strategy-wise of how do we best engage a member in the way that they want to engage? How do we best deliver information in a way that they want that information and yet do it in a consistent and efficient way on the association side? So, you know, those would be a couple kind of one is more big picture about the industry. One's maybe more a little bigger picture about the future of how associations work and how we need to make sure we're continually evolving and staying as innovative as we need to.
No, thanks for your comments there, Mark. Are you seeing an increased level of competition in that genetic evaluation space? And I guess from our perspective, I guess we see that, and I'm interested in your thinking what will happen in the next few years, Mark, in that space. Do you think that's going to continue to move forward and have new players, or what's your thinking there?
Yeah, it's hard to imagine that it's not going to continue. And, you know, for us, one of the areas is our beef on dairy. And for maybe those not as familiar with what, I mean, we've had a pretty radical transition of our dairy industry in the last, decade in particular, about 9.3, 9.4 million dairy cows, and about 60% of those are having beef calves today, being bred to largely Angus bulls. And those are big supply chains. We tend to see, you know, those are going into some big supply chains, and the amount of data that's being able to get captured out of that, whether it's health data, maybe it's whether it's feed efficiency data, it's a different system. And but because it's a far more, I'll say more, far more integrated system, the ability to capture data out of that system is much higher. And so that's probably one of the biggest accelerators we have in this space today is that beef on dairy system and the ability to capture more data. And where, you know, where we can capture data on economically important traits, if I always say, if we as a breed association aren't characterizing those traits, someone will. If there's value there, it will get discovered. And whether that's a private company, whether that's, you know, some of these supply chains working together, I think it's a challenge for breed associations to be able to stay as innovative as we need to be, and to be able to make sure we're running as fast as we need to, as staying relevant for our breeders and delivering those tools.
No, thanks, Mark. Mark, one of the key programs which you've championed is the World Angus Evaluation. So that's been an important tool between yourselves in the US, Canada, Australia, and our New Zealand members that are part of Angus Australia that record with us. Where do you see the next iteration of that World Angus Evaluation, Mark? Do you have thoughts of where it should progress next, and any thoughts along further collaboration there?
Well, I think it's been a great model of collaboration. I hope it's we find it from our perspective very advantageous. You know, I think again, I go back to the value of this phenotypic data. You run in some different environments than we run in. I think being able to see how these genetics perform in different environments is so valuable, and collectively being able to maybe pool this data more than what we had done before, I think gives us all and we talk about a common currency around here a little bit more mm-hmm. with our commercial producers, but with the World Angus Evaluation, to where our breeders, both whether in the U.S. looking to Australia, or an Australia breeder looking to the U.S., being able to maybe more accurately assess those genetics and kind of know how those genetics might be an opportunity for them to use in their operation. I think, you know, one of the things I always get a little concerned about is the narrowing of a gene pool as we get more technology and more mm-hmm. genomics. If we look in the dairy industry, you know, there here in the States, that gene pool has gotten pretty narrow. And I think what we've been able to do by working together, it's been able, I would hope, to give all our breeders more access to some diverse genetics, maybe some outcross genetics, and be able to evaluate those genetics on a kind of a common currency or in a common evaluation to take some of that guesswork out. So I hope that's we see that as beneficial. We think it's good for, you know, the global marketplace, and I think just being able to characterize these genetics in some different environments is a valuable thing. I think we have so many similarities as associations or societies to take care of members and to help our members. One of the things that we talk an awful lot about is how do we make sure we're helping our independent breeders stay independent. I know here in the U.S., there's a very, very strong desire of our breeders and cattlemen to not be part of an integrated system where the breeding and the genetic decisions are taken out of their hands, or where they don't have access to those tools. And I would think probably that's a similarity across all our members. And I think strong associations are a hedge to keep that from happening. So anything we can do to bolster that and to further strengthen our collaborative work together, I think is a very, very positive thing. And does that continue to, in time, maybe some other countries that I know, Scott, there in Australia, when we talked at our secretariat about the World Angus Evaluation, I think, again, not trying to be boastful, but I think there was some envy from maybe some of the other countries of maybe being able to potentially someday be able to participate in the World Angus Evaluation. They probably have some work to do in terms of their data structure and some consistent reporting of traits and that sort of thing. But who knows where that might go long term.
Yeah, that's right, Mark. I think there was a desire there for those up-and-coming countries that are growing their systems and their numbers to be a part of that. I would echo your comments, Mark. There's a great advantage in being an independent member-owned organisation that controls its own destiny rather than a board of directors for a profit-based company. So I think there's sometimes that gets forgotten by people at times that there's a great strength in whether it's your association or our society controlling that future. I think that's very important. Mark, you had a bit of a tricky year last year with you've moved into the methane space a bit, and there's a lot of research going on in Australia and the US as well and around the world in that. How did it, what's the wash up from your point of view? And I guess mainly interested in, where do you see that type of research going in the future rather than the political side? But yeah, how do you see that helping the industry going forward?
Yeah, no doubt. It was we had some controversy. We had some disgruntled members, and for those we were excited to be a part of the collaboration led by Dr. Miller there, largely in Australia, and to be a part of a multi-country research project like this. And I think, you know, we weren't in any way attempting to enter into the debate around cows and climate change. We simply saw it as a path to advance some research on discovering some differences in efficiency of cows, in particular cows out on grass. We just don't have very much data, and the ability to measure methane was as that measure of efficiency was something we saw an awful lot of appeal in. And the funding source of the Bezos Earth Fund and the Global Methane Hub and how those things, I think there was, respectful to those members that, were a little either leery, concerned, offended by that funding source. And then, probably one of our biggest challenges through all of this was getting factual information out to our members. And in the era and the world of social media, a narrative can get started that is simply not true, but it is hard to at times to get that bell unrung and to get the factual information out. So we worked awfully hard through the summer. I had I traveled. I went to as many meetings as I could go to be face to face. We put a lot of information out. Ultimately, when we got to our annual meeting in November, and again had a chance to kind of sit down for the first time with our membership, with all our delegates, with our leadership of our board, kind of we spent time really walking through the project from head to tail, what our objectives were, what were not our objectives. I won't tell you that every member is excited about where we're at, but at the end of the day, I think the vast majority of our members, per looking at polling we've done and the votes for who they elected to the board, we're very much in support of the direction. So, again, I'm respectful of members that have some concern around this space. It definitely is. It can be an emotional one, and people feel very strongly about sometimes the entire topic of sustainability. I get that. I respect that. And again, our objective, and I'm excited about what this research we could potentially be able to find some genetic differences in efficiency that we can apply, and if we can find those cows that produce more with less, that's a good thing for the beef industry. That's a good thing for the Angus breed.
That's a great overview, Mark. And it'd be quite interesting to see some of the outcomes of this research. It's a long time, isn't it, from conception to recording to being able to use that data. So it's really over
very
the
much
horizon. Mark, as CEO, just to delve into your role a little bit more personally there, if you had, I always like to ask the question, if you had good mentors in your career. You've got a pretty intense job with a large association there, and you've had quite a journey coming to this point. Yeah, who are some of those, or what type of mentors have you had along the way that have assisted you get to where you are?
I have been incredibly blessed with starting with fantastic parents that, while they did not come from, have some big, neither one of them went to college, neither one of them knew a lot about the beef industry, but they were incredibly supportive of me and all our my siblings of whatever we wanted to pursue. Always adamant about, you know, you need to go to college and you needed to, you know, need to go get an education. And so I, you know, I was blessed with that kind of support and upbringing. Along the way, had teachers and coaches that really always that poured into me. You know, typical of those mentors. They tend to see more in you than you can see in yourself, and they help you try to polish off the rough edges. You know, a couple along the way that, you know, Dr. Larry Cora would have hired me and hired John Sticka, both at Certified Angus Beef, the current president. Larry was an incredible mentor, still is a mentor. When I hit tough spots, I pick up the phone and call Larry. And Dr. Cora is one that just was a fantastic in terms of, he was my boss at Certified Angus Beef, but, you know, introduced me to so many people in the industry, was just an incredible supporter and encourager, incredibly wise. At Michigan State, I had the very good fortune of being there when Dr. Harlan Ritchie, Dr. Dave Hawkins, Dr. Maynard Hoberg, all we have here in the States, something called the Saddle and Sirloin Portrait Gallery. It's kind of the Livestock Hall of Fame. All three of those gentlemen are they induct one person per year, and all three of those gentlemen are in the Saddle Sirloin Portrait Gallery. And I got a chance to be at Michigan State and being mentored by all three of them at the same time. And my wife and I both, she was in grad school. And so that was a privilege that I don't take lightly at all. And so those are some that come to mind, maybe a little bit. And I hope John Sticka doesn't listen to this podcast, but John Sticka is also would be, he and I are basically identical. He's a year older than me, but I've gotten to work alongside John for now 26 years and knew him before that. And John's an incredible leader and an incredible friend, but I also get to call him a mentor as well. And so, you know, those are some, I guess, Scott, that pop into my mind initially. That boy, I'm sure blessed and fortunate that they took an interest in me.
That's great. I've noticed that you and John are particularly good mates, and you seem to have a good way of bouncing off one another. And we're very fortunate to have John come out to the World Angus Forum too and speak. And I've enjoyed his company, getting to know John as well. Mark, any books that you can think that you've read that are on helping form your career, your ideas, your strategies? Any top picks that you might give the listeners today?
I tell you, the book that probably shaped my leadership style, or maybe helped me understand my leadership style, or the one I aspired to most, it's called The Servant by James Hunter. And we made that mandatory reading at Certified Angus Beef, and I still highly encourage it here. It's been around now for a little bit. It's got a Christian faith base to it, but it is, you know, servant style leadership is kind of it was kind of a buzz term maybe 20 years ago. I still think it's a pretty powerful blueprint to the leader, at least I want to try to be. And so that's one I would tell you is probably, you know, on my greatest hits list for sure. I try to read quite a bit. I at least try to listen to podcasts. I tend to. It seems no matter which of those kind of leadership development books I read, there's always great reminders or great nuggets that you can grow from.
Well, that's a good title for us to have a read of. I haven't read that book, so thanks for the tip, Mark.
Oh, you bet.
Mark, I guess when you listeners will be wondering what your thoughts are, do you have any, after your observations of our industry and the larger breed, not just in Australia, Anything that our listeners and Angus cattle breeders in Australia should be thinking about going forward over the horizon that you think should be front and center, Mark?
Oh gosh, you've got such bright breeders and great leadership there. I'd feel inadequate to offer up anything. I guess, you know, I think probably some of the things we notice here in our industry and trends we're observing around some of the things we've already talked about, I would think are probably probably things your breeders want to have on their radar screen, making sure we've got access to data, making sure you've got the tools that you need. You know, I do think we, and we have to be careful, I guess, at times, but, you know, really making sure we pay attention to the consumer of our product. I think that, and if I've seen the traps here in the States, at least, is when we take our eye off of that ball, when we take our eye off of the ball of what really drives value and repeat business for the consumer, we tend to stub our toe a little bit. Now that doesn't mean, we believe marbling and the data says marbling is awfully important. It's not you can't forget everything else. So I hope no one hears me say single trait select for marbling. But, you know, I think that's, you know, we're having discussions here. We had to add in our U.S. grading system a new abundant category to our marbling score on the highest end of prime now. We're having discussions around segregating our certified Angus beef prime and is there a line extension of the top end of that? So we think that we can continue to improve the marbling and the quality of our product without sacrificing all the important maternal and production traits along with it. So I think with the tools and with the data, I think it seems at times I maybe talk to, and we have folks here in the States that believe those two are so antagonistic that if you breed for carcass merit, you got to give up the cow. I challenge that thought process. I don't think it's true.
That's a good message, Mark. No, thank you. And Mark, probably the last question, the most important one, is what's the best beef eating experience that you've had, Mark? And I imagine in your role, you've been blessed to have quite a few.
Oh my gosh, I call myself a steak snob now, Scott. I mean, I truly do. I've made my children steak snobs. We had we have a culinary center at Certified Angus Beef that has a meats lab, and so my kids got very, very accustomed to only eating Certified Angus Beef and prime and aged, and so I'm a total steak snob. I will tell you one of the most memorable steaks I've ever had. Of course, any steak I enjoyed with my wife is my top pick. Okay, do I do that good? I had Valentine's Day dinner the other night with my wife. That's the best, right? Short of those dinners, we're working with a small packing company in St. Louis called Tarpoff Packing. Right when we were launching Certified Angus Beef Prime, he was a small packer, but he was starting, and he also owned a little, he and his wife ran a little steakhouse. And I went in there one night and he served us up a dry aged New York strip certified Angus beef prime, been dry aged. And it was such a memorable experience. I remember at the time thinking, okay, if we can produce this product, price is not going to be a problem. So I don't know if that's the best steak I've ever had, but I remember that was a light bulb moment for me that was the best steak I'd had up to that point. So I'm pretty spoiled now, but that one was memorable.
That's fantastic, Mark. Mark, look, thank you for joining us on Angus Table today. It's an absolute pleasure. I always enjoy our conversations. And I think if we lived a little closer, we'd be very good friends. We'd catch up more than we do. But thanks for your insights. Thanks for speaking to our members and people today, Mark. Great to have you on the Angus Table.
Well, I reciprocate that respect, it's sure a privilege to come on and be a part of the program and really admire what you and the breeders there in Australia are doing with the Angus breed. And we always love hosting guests. We, as you mentioned earlier, we get the chance to do that from time to time. So I would extend an open invitation to any of your members. If they're ever in the States, I hope they'd come look us up. And we'd love to reciprocate on some of that hospitality that you showed us last summer. And World Angus Forum 2029, we'll be excited to have you then too.
We'll be very much looking forward to visiting you, Mark, and thank you for that open invitation. I think a lot of Australians make trips to the US and they appreciate that. Thanks again, Mark, for joining us. Absolute pleasure to chat this morning. Thanks.
Thanks for joining us today.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of The Angus Table. We look forward to bringing you more conversations that support your success in the Angus breed and your farming operation. I'm Scott Wright, CEO of Angus Australia, and today's Angus Table podcast is produced by Mel Strasberg. Until next time, all the best.